Cabinet Office Minister Kate Lord-Brennan is leading on government's building and development reform programme and is looking to change the Isle of Man's strategic plan. This document pretty much governs how all future development can proceed, identifying areas of housing need and setting policies which dictate what development can take place in the countryside, how biodiversity will be protected, what our community should look like, and much more. Earlier this week, I spoke to the Minister and one of her officers about the strategic plan consultation.
Yeah, so I'm Ethan Grubb. I'm a Senior Planning Policy Officer in Cabinet Office. I've been working there since 2017. And I was part of the very small team that brought the area plan for the east to Tynwald and subsequent approval.
Okay, so you're here, both of you, primarily to talk about the review of the strategic plan. Now, a number of people might wonder what the strategic plan is. They've probably heard of our island plan, but maybe they wouldn't necessarily know about the strategic planner, but really they ought to, oughtn't they, Kate Lord-Brennan?
That's right. I mean, really, the strategic plan is the backbone of planning policy on the Isle of Man, so it's the key frame of reference for decisions that are made by planning committees, you know, whether that's the actual committee itself, delegated responsibilities by DEFRA officers or planning inspectors. So it's the frame of reference that decision makers look at when deciding whether to, you know, approve or reject proposals and planning applications. And I guess from a bird's eye view, it's really looking at the spatial plan for the island and expressing it in policy terms that should be there for the long term, but also reflect existing government plans.
And that strategic plan has been in place now for, well, is it 2016 it was put in place or how does that work, Ethan?
Some of the policies are as old as, you know, 2004, 2003. The last review was in 2016 when they only looked at housing and population figures, so everything in there is pre-2011.
And of course those figures change quite dramatically, and I remember having many debates about the strategic plan, none of which seemed to get us particularly any further forward. But the issue about population, for example, it would limit certain areas and in ways that perhaps it wasn't originally planned to do. Obviously, Kate Lord-Brennan, I mean, your government has some very ambitious plans in relation to growing the population. So presumably that's one of the reasons you'll need to alter the strategic plan.
It is important the strategic plan is able to take account of your government and Tynwald approved policy and also data. So, for example, on the data side of things, you know, we know that we need to increase housing supply, and we know that there is a long-term goal to grow the population. So that needs to be able to be reflected in terms of, you know, housing numbers, really, and some of the data that's brought forward by the objective housing, you know, objective assessment of housing needs will be taken into account in terms of the strategic plan. And so although it's a statutory requirement in terms of updating the strategic plan, it is, as you said, it's the first full update to that plan, you know, for a long, long time. All the more reason that since that government and Tynwald have approved, you know, the goals and the economic strategy and the island plan, that those will need to be taken account of in spatial terms and in policy terms.
And there's around about, I haven't got the exact figure, but it's around about 200 pages worth of information for people to absorb and comment on. Three evidence papers. So there's the Island Spatial Strategy, the Rural Change and Housing Issues paper, and the Biodiversity Net Gain. So maybe if we start with Island Spatial Strategy Options. It all sounds very grand. What's in there?
So the settlement hierarchy within the current strategic plan sets out what level of development each settlement currently gets or should get. When we're reviewing that, we're really going to be looking at the settlements across the island that may not already be recognised as settlements, try to find additional opportunities where we could develop, and where communities need room to grow. At the moment, most of the housing is focused around Douglas because the current strategic plan says so. That's something we can look at in the future, and we can maybe put more houses perhaps in Ramsey or perhaps in Peel or perhaps in the south where we had the Castletown Housing Land Review because there wasn't enough houses identified at the time. So it's a lot of opportunities for us there to really help those smaller communities.
And of course, in relation to that, the strategic plan, this does have quite a dramatic impact on how the island will look in the future, because if, as you're suggesting there, you're going to change some of the focus, perhaps to have more settlement outside of Douglas, then clearly you need to have more job opportunities outside of Douglas, which will alter the whole way in which people, businessmen, a bit business people view the island and so on and so forth. Is there a strong sort of move or strong support in council of ministers across Tymal, would you say, Kate Lubrennan, for a more diverse Isle of Man rather than all sort of centred in the east in the sort of Douglas Onken area?
Well, I think it is definitely recognised that we are a small island. You need to look at this stuff strategically, and it's really helpful, I think, that we've got clear goals that we can reflect in the long-term policy, because you do need to try and align the development of future infrastructure and services and where housing goes and where facilities go over the long term. There is definitely a passion and a will to look at renewing town centres and bring back the vibrancy to town centres. So how urban regeneration can look and how that's kind of focused in our commitment to kind of have a town centre first policy and build better communities will be reflected in that strategic plan. So for people that are looking at the documents around this very initial early stage publicity, and there's multiple stages in this, it's actually quite a long process to make sure it is a democratic process and people can be involved, but people will identify some of the key themes that are in the island plan reflected in the strategic plan proposals, and lots of that is about making the Isle of Man a more vibrant place, particularly dealing with some urban regeneration stuff in town centres. But things need to be in balance with that economic side and also the climate change requirements. All of this needs to be put into balance, so you'll see that coming through in proposals too.
And I remember a WAG in the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry used to describe things that really hadn't moved very far as in the advanced pre-planning stage. This is the advanced what's it called, pre-publicity stage. What is this stage? Ethan, maybe you can talk us through all the stages of the actual process of changing the strategic plan.
Yeah, so the preliminary publicity stage is the very first step in Schedule 1 in the Town and Country Planning Act. So what that is basically we're just setting out all of the issues and topics that the strategic plan will look at. Obviously, the strategic plan covers almost everything, so it's almost impossible to create a questionnaire that anyone could have the attention span to complete for absolutely everything. So we've just picked out a few key topics that we've heard in the past that people are interested in or have quite a large impact. So things like biodiversity, net gain, housing, and how the rural communities develop. After this stage, we have a statutory time limit of 1 year to produce the actual draft plan itself. So at that point, we'll have even more engagement, even more consultation, and we'll hopefully have a few facilitated workshops, focused sessions, where we can really have deep dives into individual policies and proposals.
And presumably, Minister, you'll be involved, at least, if not leading the the public consultation stage. Has there been much thought into how that's actually going to take place? Are there going to be regional meetings, or how is that going to work?
Well, there's, I think the key, one of the key focus points for the next step in this will be a public inquiry. That's what happens after you've had the draft strategic plan published. You know, after that year process of what will have been up until that point, lots of conversations. Really, you know, it's quite like a free flowing conversation, so people can give their feedback in. There's conversations that happen with local authorities as well. You know, isn't there, Ethan?
And we fluid right up until Cabinet Office adopt the plan itself.
Yeah. So this carries on up until the point you've got public inquiry, which is held by a planning inspector, and that will be in autumn next year. And then the next step will be that Cabinet Office would have to decide to adopt the plan, and then it would go to Tynwald. So I'm quite comfortable that at this early engagement stage, it's with the communities, it's with the public, and it's with the officers. And then obviously down the line, once it gets to something which actually is put to the test for Cabinet Office, for the Council of Ministers and Tynwald, then that's certainly when I'll be seeking to be satisfied that it's in order, and I'm comfortable to promote it in Tynwald. But it's actually a really important thing to address and bring forward. So it's actually, I'm very enthused by the approach and the opportunity that I think will come from it.
And in terms then of what you're looking for at the moment from members of the public, you have your three evidence papers, but there are, effectively, I think from what you're saying, this is the opportunity really for people to think perhaps a bit out of the box, a bit of blue sky thinking of, how would you like the Isle of Man to look over the next 10, 20, maybe 30 years' time? And if once you've thought of what your vision is going to be for the future, what needs to change to allow that to happen? Is that the kind of high level sort of thinking that you're looking for in terms of the consultation?
I think from my perspective, absolutely is. And that very point that you've made there, how do you see the island looking in the future? I mean, I think we might talk a bit about the government conference separately, but as part of that early stage of the government conference, we're talking to younger people, and I'm hopeful that we can have some kind of engagement around that to say, well, how do you see the island looking in the future? How do you want it to look in the future? Because when you make these plans, they are long term, so you need to think about the long term, and you need to understand certainly what people would want to see, how they want places to look and feel. So that that's absolutely the sort of way that we need to be thinking about it. And that boils down to lots of other things that could be other influencing factors over. For example, we know that it's really important and healthy for so many reasons to have the right amount of space for children to play. Now, there can be certain amounts of things that can happen through area plans where you can be hopeful that somebody puts forward some land to say, yeah, we will provide that or say that that's a potential for play space, local amenity. Now, that doesn't always happen, but actually what you can require at a higher level strategic planning policy level is to say, a certain amount of regard needs to be given to the provision of play space for children. And then that will sit over all of these things, because the idea is, and certainly it's laid out in statute, and I know it's complicated, but the area plans, that's the ones with the maps, when they're devised and developed, they should be brought forward in general conformity with the strategic plan. So yes, it should represent a vision for what people want to see on the island in the future and how it looks.
Just briefly then, touching on, because you mentioned the area plans, and of course the north and west still haven't had an updated plan for quite some years. I mean, the south was first. I remember it well, going through Tynwald, despite the best endeavours of the three Russian members, who felt that it was entirely inappropriate in a number of ways. But there we are. Then the east, the eastern plan has been approved, hasn't it? But the north and west has been out for consultation, but it doesn't. Perhaps you could tell us where is that up to now?
The next step will be for the area plan for the north and west to go to a public inquiry. So that's the next step with that, and that's the plan. That's happening. We did take a thorough approach to public engagement at the start of this administration. It was quite, I think, uniquely handled in terms of, I said that there needs to be proper community engagement. People in the north and west of the island, they got a a little leaflet through the door, didn't they, to say, you know, here's what that area plan means, and a community guide to it. So yeah, that will go forward to public inquiry, and the next steps, you know, dependent on how that goes, would be to seek adoption of that by the Cabinet Office, potential amendment. Then we need to go to Council Ministers and then to Tynwald for approval. The longer term, bigger picture side of things, you know, it's already sort of set out in the Cabinet Office plan, the timelines to start the approach for an all island area plan, which, if you think about what we're doing with the strategic plan and our known government commitments and goals, and the fact that we're a small island, it clearly makes sense to have an all-island area plan, which would pick up other aspects, importantly the south, and take a longer term look at the whole of the island. So work on that, you know, is set to commence prior to the end of this administration as per the Cabinet Office plan.
And of course things like the Climate Change Act have a dramatic impact as well on where you go with planning policy. You're listening to Cabinet Office Minister Kate Lord-Brennan, MHK, discussing the consultation on the strategic plan.
So the simple version is the area plan deals with land use proposals. So there's maps and a written statement, whereas the strategic plan is purely just a written statement with the high-level policies in, with maybe a spatial diagram in it.
It doesn't deal with land designation. The strategic plan doesn't deal with land designation, and area plans rely on things coming forward in a call for sites.
Mm. Yeah. So effectively the strategic plan talks about, as we've been discussing, the high level policy objectives for the planning system, and the area plan gets into a more detail as to what goes where. That's how it works, isn't it? Yeah, well, you're both nodding. Sadly, nodding doesn't work that well on radio. But
we agree, Phil, we agree.
So then, going back then to the strategic plan, so this is effectively, it'll be sort of progressing in tandem with the North and West Area Plan, although not directly connected. The things that you've put forward in terms of evidence papers, what was the thinking behind the you know, why particularly three evidence papers? There's the environment, the sort of local, rural, and housing, and then I forget what was the third. What was the purpose? What drove you to produce evidence papers on those three issues, and maybe not on others?
So the paper on the environment, because the Climate Change Act puts a statutory obligation on Cabinet Office to have regard for the maximisation of carbon sequestration, the minimising of greenhouse gas emissions, the maintenance and restoration of ecosystems, biodiversity net gain, and the requirement for sustainable urban drainage. That's a topic that even in the UK they still haven't really got to grips with. So having a Manx version of that in the time frame is in and of itself a challenge. So having community input early is critical to really put together hopefully some policies that are acceptable and create some desirable outcomes.
And what does biodiversity net gain actually mean? Because it sounds rather grand, but what are the practical, pragmatic steps that deliver this?
Yeah. So if you were to develop a greenfield site, you would do an ecological appraisal of that site and quantify what element of nature is effectively lost. And you'd have to then replace it more so. Whatever that percentage increase will be is something to be determined at the moment, because at the moment we have no net loss. So if you were to have one rare orchid removed, you would have to replace that one rare orchid, for instance. So no net loss. During the area plan for the East, we did actually try to bring biodiversity net gain into the actual development briefs, but we were quite rightly pointed out by the inspector that the strategic plan says no net loss, and that's as far as it got. But it has been something in the back of our minds for quite a while. The other papers, obviously with housing, that's being quite an important one, because at the moment the current strategic plan methodology of calculating housing is quite crude. So we basically just take residents and private households and number of households, divide it to get a average household size, and then add 4% for choice and churn in the market. That's effectively the calculation. At the very first stage of that, you're already excluding a portion of the population in institutional care, for instance. So we've commissioned the objective assessment of housing needs, so we'll start looking at that much more holistically, and then we can actually get targets for first-time buyers, for instance, care home, as well as the how many two beds, three beds, four beds, etc. we need.
And housing, of course, housing need can change quite dramatically. Certainly back in 2016, when I was still housing minister, we didn't really seem to have much of a housing problem. And I don't claim any credit for us not having a housing problem at that time. But over the course of the next 5 years, things changed quite dramatically. And then by the 2021 general election, there was talk of a housing crisis, and I think most members who were elected spoke of this. So effectively, this is part of the objective of the plan, presumably, Minister, that it can be responsive enough to ensure that as we move forward over the next 10-20 years, that the planning system at least encourages that housing need to be met via various people who may wish to develop properties over that period.
Yes, and you know, there is a need for that planning policy to be able to facilitate existing government policy and public need. So it is exactly for that reason. It won't in and of itself solve the more immediate housing supply issues, but yes, there is a responsibility to make sure that the strategic plan, whilst it is being updated, is fit for the long term and is best informed in a sort of calculation, if you like, that is acceptable. So it's just really one strand of that, but it won't solve the whole aspect of it.
And another element of what's being reviewed is the sort of rural development. And certainly, as a clerk to a rural authority, I know that often issues crop up in relation to things like agricultural workers' cottages or indeed agricultural barns. And policy is possibly several decades out of date in that area now, isn't it?
I certainly come across cases like this as a constituency MHK, where there is a desire to improve something, and actually sometimes it feels like there are blockers, and sometimes it might be a process through the planning process side of things, and other times there's an indication that it's to do with a particular sort of use or policy reference. So for people who face those sort of frustrations that have perhaps actually been identified as policy frustrations or something that needs to be drawn out or clarified more, or as you've or unblocked, if you like, given a chance, that instance that you've described there, I would really encourage people to engage with the strategic plan process. And if you're put off by the different very detailed evidence documents, the planning policy team are very easy to deal with. You can just get in touch and you could sort of put across a scenario and say, look, I find that this is a problem, or my architect has told me that this is an issue, or when I put a planning application in, I've sort of felt like things are stuck for this reason. It's not always a policy issue, I'm absolutely clear about that, but where you've got things that are not quite meeting the needs now, then it absolutely is a chance to update and change. So we'd really encourage people to come forward and tell us about those things.
And one of the suggestions in there is instead of using agriculture as the be all and end all for development in the countryside, that maybe rural employment is a better use of terminology. But then, of course, what is rural employment?
Or is it tourism? Or is something?
And of course, it's all in the definition, isn't it? And your difficult job, Ethan, as a civil servant, is making sure that these definitions are clear enough to include everything that needs to be included, but not vague enough to to not be clear.
Yeah, open the system up for sort of misuse and the like. That's one issue. We've got to try and strike that balance, and we've got to do it on a sound evidence base as well. So we will be looking at, you know, obviously things like the census and conducting our own surveys ourselves to try and really get to grips with what the needs are in different areas and what people are actually doing for employment.
Planning policy and the application of that, which is really, you know, more of an art than a science, you know, when it comes to the other side of things, assessing applications and things, you know, it should be about good development. It should be about, you know, things happening which are sympathetic and appropriate and going to add to the lives and like the economy and the environment in a way that is not detrimental. So in that respect, it should be a positive way forward with a good, healthy framework that allows that for people who want to, you know, develop, put forward new ideas, make changes to their homes, use town centres in a better way, work closer to where they live, or, you know, have play spaces for their kids to go nearby.
And of course, your government has bold ambition for achieving all sorts of wonderful things over the course of the next 10 to 15 years. Do you get frustrated at the inevitable slow pace of change? I mean, in terms of review and change of the strategic plan, for example, this is an inevitable at least 2-year process to actually undertake. Whereas ministers who've come in with all this vim and vigour and eagerness to start making big improvements, you probably want to see action more quickly than perhaps some of the longer time frames allow.
Well, I think that because this is a policy document and it's not determining any specifics, and in fact there's other government initiatives going on that very much do and will determine specifics, and I think that there's a likelihood that we'll see some of those things announced at the government conference. So I don't feel frustrated so much in that element to do with the strategic plan, because actually you've got to have regard for the fact that the process of that, well, it's necessarily very detailed, and it's also got a time frame that's set out in statute too. So you know, it's a necessary but long process. But I'm glad all the same that it's happening and that it's underway during this stage in this government. I think it's come at exactly the right time.
You've mentioned there the government conference, and of course there is going to be an opportunity on Wednesday evening to find out all about the strategic plan. What is the thinking there? You're presumably hoping that as many people as possible will come along and find out about this.
Well, I think we often hear criticism about government always talking about plans, don't we? You know, it's one plan after another. But you know, it's understanding really for people what the strategic plan is. I think there'll be certain people that are more interested in this than others, and it's a way just to kind of open out that engagement to explain the role of the strategic plan, how people can engage in the process in the initial preliminary publicity, but then also down the line if they want to make representations. And to be absolutely honest, Phil, it's something that lends itself much more to your visual presentation rather than, you know, trying to explain it in writing or indeed talking about it. So I'm really, really happy that the time has come to be able, and it's good timing for the government conference to be able to explain this. People can come along, they can ask questions. The consultation is still going to run for a few weeks after, beyond the government conference, and it's really fitting in with this theme that the conference has, building on last year. You remember us talking about it then, about placemaking and the role of planning. So the following day, we've got a keynote talk from Sue Bridge, who is the president of the Royal Town Planning Institute. So it's actually brilliant that we've got experienced expertise from off island coming to talk to us and engaging with people here, as well as being able to come forward with our plans that are reflecting the government and Tim Walz approved director for the island for the future. So it's tying in all together, really. So I really do encourage people to come along and find out more.
And Ethan, presumably you're pulling the exciting slides and visual presentation together.
Another colleague of mine, so I've dodged that bullet. But I will be hanging around in the promenade suite, you know, sort of an hour before and a little bit after. So if anyone has any questions about the strategic plan, I'll be there to answer anything.
Great. And in terms of the feedback to the consultation, when does that end?
With the consultation closing on the 29th of September, we give a little bit of leeway for everyone to get their responses in. If it's going to be late, you know, people can just let us know and we'll know to keep an eye out for it. But we hope to get the summary of responses out as soon as possible.
Before Christmas?
Hopefully before Christmas, but I, you know, how long is a piece of string? If we get a good response of a few thousand, yeah, then it might take a little bit longer. But as it stands now, we should have it out in good time.
And Minister, going back then to the conference, there is loads happening. I am, as I say, probably one of the few people on the Isle of Man who's genuinely gutted that I'm going to miss it for various reasons. But what are the highlights in that conference for you?
You know, I think you're never going to get away from the fact that the key issues that people are bothered about are about education, they're about the public finances of the island, and they're about how things look in the world around us to do with infrastructure and the built environment. I think there's also a good opportunity for people to come and question ministers and senior officials about topics to do with health, as well as skills and employment and the future economic strategy. I've been reflecting on the government conference just, you know, the past couple of weeks. And, you know, of course it's the case that people can go and talk to their constituency MHKs. And ministers, of course, you know, answer questions in the House of Keys and Tynwald, and, you know, news releases get sent out. But there really isn't anything that's aside from the government conference that fills this direct engagement role as being a chance for government to explain directly what we've been working on in the past year, making some new announcements in key areas. I think, you know, is something that I'm expecting to happen. And also for the public to ask questions directly to decision makers. So there is quite a packed schedule. We've adjusted that schedule based on feedback from last year. So it will start on the evening of Wednesday, the 30th of September, with the topics to do with education and also skills and employment. So the Education Minister will present them. There'll be a panel Q&A. The next day, there's a focus on finance and budgets. And moving on then in the afternoon to things around the economic strategy and some of the progress really to do with built environment and infrastructure projects, and that keynote talk there from Sue Bridge as well. In addition to the main sessions, there's sort of side sessions set out in other parts of the Villa Marina, direct Q&As.
I'll have to... I hate to do this, but I'll have to correct you. It was Wednesday the 20th, isn't it? Not the 30th.
Sorry, yeah, Wednesday the 20th. Thank you. Yeah.
And for those, I mean, because there are people like me who might go to a conference like this and would have no worries or concerns whatsoever of standing up in front of a room of hundreds of people and making comments. Is there any opportunity for people who may be a little bit shyer or not used to public speaking? Will they have opportunities to feed into this without necessarily having to speak in front of the vast assembled crowds?
Yes, I would say in a couple of ways, really. I mean, for people who came to the government conference last year, they'd find it probably to be quite an informal buzz around the villa, which is the same venue this year. You know, ministers will be around, you know, so you can, you know, approach ministers or even senior officers, and if you wanted to have a chat. But also the way that it's set out, particularly in the ministerial Q&As, the Treasury Minister is doing those, so is the Chief Minister, and the Health Minister is doing one too. You know, you're not people shouldn't be put off by thinking, feeling conscious about asking a question, because the way it can be handled is that, you know, it can also be done in a way which you know, people effectively message questions in as well. And in that smaller environment for the Q&As, you know, it does feel like quite like a sort of relaxed but focused area. So it, you know, it isn't something that you know, if you're more reserved, don't be put off. Please do come along and take the chance to engage and ask questions. And we do look at the sort of topics that people are raising and challenging, and the Q&A panels have got people on that, you know, it's not just people from government. We've made sure to include lots of different voices, because it adds to this, you know, policy and discussion and debate in a way that you just don't see in any other forum.
And of course, the other exciting news is that there'll be an infrastructure minister there, who isn't the chief minister. There are two schools of thought, aren't there, about this? When you have both of your constituency MHKs as ministers, some people take the view that, oh well, that means that they're silenced and they're not able to speak up and say it how it is for the constituents. But of course, those of us who've served as ministers would argue, perhaps you'll agree with this, or perhaps not, that you have the opportunity in Council of Ministers to influence, and actually that's a far bigger opportunity than maybe mouthing off occasionally in Tynwald.
I think it's about impact, isn't it, really? And I think that you've got to be able to balance both. It's a lot of work when you are doing both. So I think that people who know me know that I don't have any hesitation in speaking up or speaking out, and I'm still the same now. And from a constituency perspective, for me, I try and find the best way to apply myself and you know, directly in the community and for the community. And then, you know, I can tell you a bit about some of the stuff I've been doing sort of in my constituency MHK hats in that respect. So it's challenging, but it's absolutely not insurmountable, because I think that the level that MHK should be working at should be looking constructively in a way that is helpful on the whole with the bigger picture. And that's how you handle your public service role, in my view.
Do you think, Abby, because it has been trialled in other places, do you think maybe some kind of public sitting of Council of Ministers mightn't be a bad idea? And you know, this would be a bold and brave step for Council of Ministers to take, but just to maybe demystify some of the processes, because certainly from my experience, some of the best debates I've ever been involved in took place in Council of Ministers, but of course the public never get to find out, really. All they ever get to discover is the outcome, not necessarily the debating point.
Well, I think you need to have that space in council to be able to speak freely and honestly and give your opinion. And I think that there needs to be space to do that, you know, for policy development reasons, and just to have that kind of robust collegiate exchange on particular issues. So to me, that would be much more important, and you know, I think it works well in that respect. Rather than sort of seeking to think about other dynamics, if you like, on the outside, rather than really focusing on the issues of the day, the decisions that week that you're making, and also the things that you're pressing up on and following up on, with the officials that are on the delivery side of things. So I think that, you know, as it stands now, you know, it works well and it's fine in that respect. For broader policy things, absolutely a great idea to bring out that public engagement as the government conference will.
I mean, you touched there on constituency work, and of course you had been quite public on your, I think it was on Facebook, I spotted discussing some constituency initiatives that you had. Are you in a position now to tell us a bit more about those?
I am, and I'm really happy to be able to say that I've got my platform nearly launched. In fact, by the time that, you know, this goes out, I'm sure that it'll be ready with a link and everything. But something that I've been working on is a constituency MHK. So I've funded it, developed it and supported it myself in conjunction with a community group that I've set up called Future Peel. And, you know, I think that There's a lot that's absolutely wonderful about Peel, and it's fantastic, and it's got lots of charm and amazing people. There's lots to love, but there are other bits about the town that actually people want to see improved or to see a bit more life in, particularly, you know, that there's always been this issue about what to do with the centre of Peel. So what I've brought forward, and something I've actually been looking at for years, Phil, because I'm just very interested in how places look, how they feel. I think we really should be striving for beautiful, vibrant town centres that serve the people who live there. So what people will be able to do is there's an online map, and people will be able to identify very easily and very quickly at a full mass public engagement level by just simply dropping a pin on the map and saying what they like, what they don't like, and what they would want to see in Peel. And it will also, by way of engagement, it's got questions about the sort of businesses and services you would like to see in the area. What do you see elsewhere that you would perhaps see would be a good initiative or type of approach for Peel as a town centre? To me, in Peel in particular, there's been lots of ideas and things like that have been talked about in the past. Lots of, you know, people tell me about will for improving things, but to me, you need to kind of draw out in a really sort of transparent way the sort of things that people want if you're to do two things: if you're to have a vision for the future of Peel and what the town should look like, and also if you're to influence any authority in the town, whether that's local authority or, you know, inform their plans, or indeed a government department. So that's the intention with that, and I hope people will participate in it, and I think it's actually a really forward-thinking way to do this sort of engagement around towns. Mm.
Because, of course, I mean, there are several known issues that often seem to vex the sort of political discussion about Peel. Parking is high on the list. The tension perhaps between old Peel and new Peel.
Yeah, you're right.
These sorts of issues, and of course Peel being a vibrant tourist destination, but quite difficult to get in and out of. I mean, these are the sorts of issues, presumably, that your group is set up to try and deal with.
Well, I think, you know, we can try and advocate and engage and draw out a representative community view. You know, it's quite clear that these functions, you know, are to be handled at other levels. But you're right, how people move around the town is important. You know, the connectivity between New Peel and Old Peel, and actually whether the town provides the right sort of offerings or businesses, you know, in a broad way. That's all absolutely, it's just so important to people. So I think it is a good opportunity. The model is from an organisation called Create Communities in the UK. So it's something that's been done elsewhere, and they use that model for engagement, direct community engagement, urban design, and master planning for areas. So this is like a first approach, really just to draw out what people in Peel want to see in their town.
And I'm going to draw Ethan in, even though it is a sort of a constituency.
It's a constituency thing.
Ethan, I mean, this must be music to your ears as a planner, that local politicians are trying to engage with their communities to understand all these complex issues, which is effectively your job as a planner on a daily basis, isn't it?
Well, it's an excellent evidence base that will be forming, that we all get to tap into and use that as a planning consideration and put that into a statutory document going forward. So it's a very exciting and useful piece of work that the minister's undertaking.
Well, if any other MHKs are listening in and fancy doing something similar in their area, I'm sure, Kate, you'd be happy to guide them.
I will. It's clear where how people can approach this for their own areas. Obviously, it takes quite a lot of, you know, work as a constituency MHK to get this underway, to fund it and work with others. So I think my priority will be to sort it out and Peel, and then maybe it will inspire others, which would be amazing.
And is it limited to Peel, or is it Peel and the greater area, including Glenfarb?
Well,
or Glenfarb? Is it Glenfarb or Glenfarb?
Yeah, well, no. Yeah, it depends who you ask. The map is, I've set out the boundary broadly with what the sort of common sense boundary for Peel is, but you know it includes a little bit going up the Ramsey Rose, includes all the castle and kind of going out past the new estates and the highwaymen. But of course Peel is it's designated as a service, it's called a service centre in planning terms for the broader areas. So I'm saying, please, if you're in Peel, that I hope you will very quickly engage with this map, and it's very quick and easy to do even for kids. But if you're in Glenmay, Patrick, Dalby, Foxdale, if you're in Kirkmichael, St John's, that Peel is the closest town. So I'm encouraging visitors and those in nearby settlements to also engage with this. That would be wonderful.
And, you say it's going online imminently. What, I suppose, in a year's time, 2 years' time, what would you hope to have got out of this exercise?
Well, I hope that it will be possible to have a longer-term strategy and vision for Peel as a town. I hope that it's a tall, big ask, I'm sure you'll know, that that there might actually be some kind of consensus or common view that is drawn out. And I would hope that when it comes to anything to do with infrastructure or responsibilities that a local authority has, that they will, respond to some of the views that will be openly, drawn out. And I would also like to think that given some ways, Peel is a bit behind other towns now, but with that comes great potential. So I'm hoping that it might also be a trigger for your businesses or entrepreneurs to start something off in the town. But also, I think that there is a real chance to attract investment into Peel, and that this sort of approach and knowing the demand and the market, there's about 5,000 people in Peel, will help.
And of course, that is one of the things that does attract people who have money to invest, is when there is a clear message that comes from a local area that says, actually, this is what we're about in Peel or Port Erin or wherever it might be. This is our message, and we've got the commissioners on board, the local MHKs are on board, there's a strong community support for this. That's what you really ideally you're looking for, aren't you?
It is. It's that signal, isn't it, that says, we want to develop, and we recognise that prosperity, investment, business activity, and also the people that live there having the amenities that they want, that is what makes them, what makes a thriving town, and for what is already a very beautiful and special part of the island.
And then finally, the strategic plan we've talked about. We talk about north and west area plan, specific plans for Peel. Lots of plans. Many people might wonder, when are we going to start seeing real actions, real change?
Well, under the Built Environment Reform Programme that we had updated on last year at the government conference, and that was one of the very first initiatives that was brought forward from Cabinet Office at the start of this administration. Some of the programmes under that are going really well and likely to show very, very good progress in terms of stuff that you would be able to see as being very tangible and very real and actually starting to make things happen. So we really are starting to see that stuff over the horizon now as a result of some of the things that were set in place, just over a year ago, really. So that is pleasing because, this stuff has to get to delivery. Some things are, just kind of research or plans or policy, but then there are very specific initiatives to do with various, infrastructure, particularly to do with the town centres, that those things are kind of on the horizon now, and it's not something that, that is my place to sort of announce or anything, but I do think some of these things are coming to fruition, and hopefully that will be able to become clear soon.
That was Cabinet Office Minister Kate Lord-Brennan, MHK, and Ethan Grubb, a Senior Planning Officer working on the review of the strategic plan. Kate Lord Brennan has certainly been busy over the summer, and if you care about how the Isle of Man looks in future decades, you really should get your views on the strategic plan submitted. There's a chance to hear more about the plan at the Isle of Man Government Conference this Wednesday evening. There are arguments for and against spending too long making plans and not long enough delivering actions, but there's also a saying, act in haste, repent at leisure. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Good on Mayo Sungeisakrum. Thanks for listening.